MacCast, Saturday, June 24th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Been a little while since we talked. It seems like, I don't know, summer schedules, family, podcasting, all those things don't always come together quite at the same times. But needless to say, happy to be back here with you for another episode. We have a lot of great things to talk about. We're getting more and more information these days on rumored iPhone 8 designs. Those things are starting to come together, so we're going to talk about all the latest on that. Apple says they're in the mother of all AI projects. We'll dive into that a little bit. Also, teardowns of the iPad Pro, what Apple hopes to do with health data and your iPhone. Also, Apple doing a couple things with TV. There was an interesting interview with former Apple executive Scott Forstall that we'll talk about a little bit. Also, a new Apple store that looks very interesting, and more details on the iMac Pro, something I'm looking forward to seeing come the end of the year. Apple's already told us they're working on it. We have a little more details kind of leaking out about what might actually be in the machine under the hood and stuff like that. We have that, and of course, a lot of great feedback and comments from you. We're going to clarify some things on stolen iPhones and activation locks. I'm going to talk a little bit about reading list and how you can use and take advantage of that. Also, what happens if your iPhone is stuck, or if your iPhone, or if your Apple Music rather, is stuck in a mode that you're not happy about. That's happened to me and happened to one of you as well. And also going to talk about mail. And then I have a letter from a member of the MacCast community to share with you. So, going to be a good show. Stay tuned for everything. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about PDF Pen 9. The new version of PDF Pen came out a couple months ago. It really is the ultimate editing tool for working with PDFs, both on your iPhone and iPad. If you're planning on going paperless, PDF Pen is a must-have utility, in my opinion. It's on every one of my Macs, every one of my iPhones. I use it all the time for doing things, not just opening up PDFs, but dealing with annotations for projects that I'm working on, sending back and forth between clients. If I need to do signatures or even fill out forms, one of my favorite features, and I've mentioned this a few times, but it is the one I probably use the most, is when I get a form that's not an actual PDF form, and it still happens all the time. You think it wouldn't in this day and age, but with PDF Pen, you can turn those into actual forms where you can fill out the fields, you can stay paperless, you don't have to print things out and then rescan them in. That's a big, giant hassle. Just do it all in PDF Pen. And PDF Pen 9 packs in over 100 new features and enhancements that will improve your PDF editing workflow. Another great thing about the folks at Smile is they're constantly working to improve their products. And when they do upgrades like this, you get a ton of great new enhancements. Things like an enhanced sidebar with an annotations view, more export options. They added a hand tool so you can pan and zoom around those giant PDFs that you sometimes get more easily. You can link now from one PDF file to another PDF file. So this is handy if you have a bunch of PDFs that maybe should go together and you want to link them, but you still want them as separate PDFs. You can also find and highlight all of a single term within a document. So that can be helpful if you deal with legal documents a lot. They've added line numbering, also helpful for programming. And they even support forms now, which can do calculations. So all of that. And then in the pro version, they've added the ability to enhance table of contents, or do table of contents editing rather. OCR for Chinese, Japanese, and Korean languages, so more OCR support. And best of all, if you already own PDF Pen and you want to upgrade, they have upgrade pricing available. So really, now is the time to grab it if you haven't upgraded yet. You can learn more about PDF Pen and actually all of Smile's great products by simply going to smilesoftware.com /MacCast. Check out PDF Pen 9 and everything else they have to offer. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Let's get into iPhone 8 rumors. I know we've been doing these for a while now, but we are getting closer to the actual launch. I know it doesn't feel like it. We're just entering summer, right? I think we just had summer solstice, first day of summer. But fall is not too far behind, and Apple will announce the next generation of iPhones. And right now is the time where iPhones are kind of going into production. Apple's lined up their suppliers. They're actually generating parts, and we're starting to see little bits and pieces coming out of the supply chain. And it's really when everything starts converging and we kind of get a clear picture of what it's going to look like, or what possibly the iPhone might look like when Apple has their keynote. Of course, nothing is quote unquote real until Apple actually announces it. And that's important to remember here. So, you know, even with all these rumors, things can still come out differently. But at this point, it's pretty likely that what we're seeing is probably what is going to be announced. And one thing we're getting a lot of right now is parts leaks. So we're starting to see front panels and back panels, both front and back glass, because it's assumed and looking like more likely that the iPhone 8 is going to be an all glass enclosure. We also have seen parts for the dual camera housing, and that seems to back up the details that you're going to have two lenses in the front-facing EyeSight camera with the flash in between. And a lot of these things are sort of mostly confirming things that we've already heard. Also that it's going to be pretty much edge-to-edge with an impossibly thin bezel and a little sensor notch around the top. There had been a lot of question about how is Apple going to handle the little area for the sensors and the FaceTime camera and the speaker grill and all that at the top of the phone. It's looking like what it's going to be is the display will come up on the left and right sides, and then you'll have this kind of tab in the middle that will house those things, and that tab will be about the height of the bar that holds the clock on the iPhone display. So it should blend one right into the other. So you're going to have, you know, the cell phone signal strength on the left-hand side and the battery indicator and the clock on the right-hand side, and it will just blend in because that OLED display that the iPhone 8 is supposed to get should be super black and dark, and it should really be unnoticeable. So it should be pretty neat. I'm getting pretty excited about the design. I don't know if you are as well, but you know, that dual lens EyeSight camera. And speaking of the, you know, camera sensors, it is expected that there's going to be a lot of 3D sensing technology in those new lenses. As a matter of fact, Apple's supplier Largan has said it's shipping 3D sensing lenses in the second half of 2017 to their customers. They didn't say, of course, specifically who they were shipping to, but they are a big supplier of Apple, and they announced that they've been planning to double their workforce to meet demands for their product. And what other company could have a massive demand for camera sensors? Yeah, Apple is looking for those things. And these things are used for things like 3D facial recognition. So the Largan sensors are expected to be the ones in the EyeSight camera. And 3D facial recognition is something we've been hearing might be in the next version of the iPhone. But it's also believed that the EyeSight camera will have 3D sensing as well. And these actually use like sensors and IR lasers to do depth mapping. And you want that if you're going to do facial recognition. It's much more secure. If you remember a while back, one of Apple's competitors did a 2D facial recognition, and it could be fooled with just a photograph. You really don't want that if you're talking about 3D facial recognition. But I really think the 3D sensing lenses in Apple's products are going further than that. I think facial recognition is a nice benefit of these sensors, but I think really what Apple's looking at them for is more of their augmented reality applications, doing things like games. They've acquired a few companies, I think, you know, building a 3D avatar of your face that you might be able to use in a game could be a really neat feature. And a lot of this technology, I think, is going to get used for that. With the front-facing cameras, I think it's going to be really important for Apple's AR efforts so that you can depth map a space very easily, feed that data into Apple's AR kit, which they showed off at Worldwide Developer Conference, And developers are going to have a really powerful platform for doing a lot of really cool things with augmented reality. Some other developments in terms of the glass on the front and backs of the displays. We've talked about the fact that Apple's probably going to have three different models of the iPhone. There's going to be, you know, the top of the line iPhone Edition, iPhone 8, which is going to be the all new design. But it's also expected that Apple was going to rev the existing iPhone 7 design. So we would get an iPhone 7 S and an iPhone 7 S Plus. And initially it was believed the design wouldn't change at all. But we're starting to hear now, and we've been hearing for the past couple weeks or so, and I think we've talked about this a little bit, that Apple may use the all-glass design also for the iPhone 7 S and 7 S Plus. And we did see some parts this week that seemed to confirm that. It's also leading to the speculation that all three models might also get a wireless charging option. Originally, it had been thought the iPhone 8 might be getting wireless charging. Now we're starting to hear that across the line, Apple will add a wireless charging option. It's not going to be a replacement to the Direct Connect Lightning charging, but just in addition to. And whether or not Apple will sell an optional wireless charging accessory or if that'll be included in box, it's not really clear at this point. But this was a theory that was first mentioned by KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, and it seems to be being backed up by a number of different things. As a matter of fact, Wistron, again, another one of Apple's suppliers, one of their assembly partners, they made statements to the fact that they were ramping up and getting ready for new processes in iPhone assembly and testing those for features like waterproofing and wireless charging. So they kind of let it slip a little bit that the new iPhones would have wireless charging. And interestingly enough, Wistron is one of Apple's smaller assembly partners, the main one being Foxconn. And they typically assemble devices like the iPhone 7 Plus. So iPhone 7 S Plus is probably what they're putting together, which kind of seems to back up that they would be there would be wireless charging in all of Apple's models. So these are the kinds of rumors and things that are happening now that we're getting closer to actual launch and production. Now, one of the things that has been up in the air has been, when is Apple going to have the iPhone 8 available? Analyst Gene Munster came out this week and said that he thinks Apple will announce all the new iPhones in September, but the iPhone 8 model probably will not be shipping until October. And he cited issues with the OLED screens as being part of that problem. And a big part of the tech in the screen is the Touch ID sensor. It's expected that the whole front is going to be glass. There's not actually going to be a home button, and Apple's going to go with a virtual button, which means for Touch ID, the sensor would be under the glass. And that has supposedly been a key factor in Apple, you know, releasing or getting enough quantities of the iPhone to ship. As a matter of fact, Cowen and Company, analyst Timothy Akuri said that the sensor is still causing issues for Apple. And while it will not be on the back, you know, one of the backup plans was supposedly, no pun intended, that Apple would add the sensor to the back, sort of like it is on Android phones. I thought that would be a terrible idea. He's saying that's not going to happen, but Apple actually has a couple different options for handling the sensor on the front. One being possibly thinning the glass cover over the sensor area to make it work a little bit better. Possibly creating a little pinhole through the glass for an optical or ultrasonic sensor. I think something that Apple wouldn't want to do. I can't imagine. I would imagine Johnny Ive would be freaking out about sort of breaking that single sheet of glass design. Or they said they could use a film sensor integrated into the display, either using capacitive or infrared technology. I thought the third option was the one that they were really going for and working on. All the rumors seem to be indicating that. So I think that's the ideal situation. And the other two are probably a backup plan. But even with the delay in sales, while Apple might not get the numbers up front, it's expected they will ultimately get the numbers for the iPhone 8. It's expected to have very, very strong demand. Thus, when it launches, I think it's also going to be in very, very short supply. We've talked about this before. If you want to get an iPhone 8, you're going to probably have trouble getting that on day one. But things are gearing up, and it's getting pretty exciting with all of these leaks. Last little comment I want to make on leaks this week is that we also saw a leak about how Apple supposedly handles leaks. So their information on dealing with leaks was actually leaked. I know, the irony, right? It's kind of crazy. This information was from a recording of an internal briefing that Apple uses to educate their incoming employees on the whole culture at Apple about, you know, leaks and why they don't want, you know, why as an employee you shouldn't be leaking information. It was published by a site called The Outline. I'll have a link to the full article in the show notes at macguest.com if you want to check it out. But basically, it outlines the fact that Apple has a global security team that includes members, for former members rather, of the NSA, FBI, Secret Service, the U.S. military. So these are like serious, serious folks, probably people you wouldn't want to necessarily mess with. And they are tasked with tracking down the sources of any leaks of Apple products to the media, things. So when we are seeing these things, these parts that are getting leaked out, these guys are the ones who go in and investigate and try and track down and find out who leaked this stuff, especially from within Apple suppliers and within Apple. And they have to deal with that. And they will hunt people down for a very long time, according to this report, if need be. They cite one example in which they say it took 3 years for them to catch a leaker who was actually at the campus in Cupertino. And interesting also in this report, Apple noted that they have so successfully been waging war on leaks. And this is probably what Tim was talking about a few years ago when he said Apple was going to double down on security. They've locked down security in the supply chain so well that in 2016, there were actually more leaks that were coming out of Apple HQ in Cupertino than were coming out of the supply chain. And I find that very surprising because it seems to me when we see these parts leaks, a lot of them are showing up on, you know, Chinese websites like Weibo and stuff like that. The fact that Apple's saying they're getting more leaks out of Cupertino was a little bit surprising. But, you know, they are reminding new employees that, hey, you know, secrecy is very important here at Apple, and you need to be thinking about it all the time, including when you're just talking to you friends and family. You know, if you're at a party, you got to be careful about what you're saying. If you're talking to your spouse or even your kids, you need to be careful about what you're talking about with relation to your products. Now, the report says Apple's not trying to maintain a big brother state, but more they try, and it sounded like they're trying to instill, you know, pride in Apple employees and saying, you know, it's a really big deal for us to be able to go up on stage, or for Tim Cook and the executive team to go up on stage and really surprise and delight our consumers. And we really don't want to ruin that. So just be diligent, be careful. You know, it's been known that Apple has public areas on their campuses that they call red zones. So those would be things like the hallways or the cafeterias. And you don't talk about sensitive projects or you know, secretive stuff when you're in those areas. It's just the general policy. And that needs to sort of extend out outside of the campus as well for employees. So it was interesting, you know, mainly from the fact that it was a leak about not having leaks. But that surfaced this week. And if you want to check it out, I'll have it in the show notes at macguest.com. But leaks are continuing to happen. And luckily for us, we get to see some of that. I know for some of you, it's frustrating because you like to be surprised and delighted. So if you're that type of person, I would say just, you know, skip over these parts of the podcast, right? But for the rest of you who enjoy kind of keeping up on this stuff, it's fun. I get excited about, you know, seeing what technology is coming out. And it's nice to get a little sneak peek. I don't mind it so much. I've kind of gotten used to it, I guess, over the years. Part of the dilemma probably of doing a podcast related to Apple technology and products. Tim Cook did an interesting Bloomberg interview where he finally basically confirmed that Apple is working on what he calls autonomous systems. Now, the assumption is that means for vehicles, but he was a little bit more general, but essentially said, yeah, we have an autonomous systems project. He actually called it the, quote, mother of all AI projects, and mentioned not only self-driving car systems as being a particular area of interest, but also talked about and pointed out the electrification of cars and the surge in ride sharing, and actually called these the three vectors of change in that space, and mentioned them sort of coming together at this point in time to be a big thing. And when he said that, I just realized that I feel stronger than ever that one of the future innovations that Apple is really driving towards is trying to disrupt personal transportation. And I've talked about this on a few podcasts. I don't know if I've really gone in depth on it here on the MacCast, but I'm convinced that Apple is ultimately wanting to build an autonomous car service, sort of like, you know, iCloud service or Apple Music for automobiles. And I think it's part of why they invested in Didi Chung, the ride-sharing service in China. I also think it's why they're heavily investing in artificial intelligence, in augmented reality, machine learning, computer vision, their whole mapping efforts. We know they have cars out on the road that are doing a complex 3D mapping, taking photos. A lot of people assumed that that was for Apple bringing a Street View-like technology to Apple Maps, but we haven't seen that happen. And I think we haven't because I think Apple's doing a massive big data collection to support this car service that they're maybe planning on building. A lot of people are just thinking, oh, they're building an autonomous car system and they're going to, I don't know, sell it to other manufacturers. But I think Apple really often wants to have the whole widget. And they have four different Lexus cars actually doing automated driving testing out on the roads in and around the Bay Area. And we know that they're doing this. So I really think what they're driving toward is in the future thinking a lot of people aren't going to own vehicles. They're not going to want to own vehicles. You won't have to deal with insurance. You won't have to deal with registration. You will just pay Apple, I think, essentially what amounts to a typical car payment. So I'm thinking service in the range of a couple hundred dollars a month, where you can just order up an autonomous vehicle when you need to go somewhere. And they will have fleets of vehicles out on the roads ready and waiting to go. I think initially it's going to be rolled out as probably more like an Uber car service. And I think they're going to probably start in China, but then expand that out. And ultimately it would just be you wouldn't own a car. I think about how often my car is just sitting in the driveway, not being used, which is most of the time. And I think a lot of people are that way. And more, I think the younger generation is getting used to things like Uber and Lyft. And again, all these ride sharing things. So it was particularly interesting to me that Tim Cook in this interview actually spelled that out. I think that was not insignificant. As far as is Apple going to build an actual car, in the interview, he just concluded with saying, look, we're looking into these technologies. We will see where that takes us. You know, in typical Apple fashion, he's not going to say, yes, we're actually working on building a car. I think ultimately they could get there. And I think, too, a lot of what they're looking into, while I believe the ultimate goal for them is this autonomous car service, I think they're planning on using a lot of these technologies in other parts of their business. I think there's a lot of cross-pollination going on here. And Apple is, of course, not committing to or divulging any single one of their efforts. And I think they're being honest about that. I think they see these technologies as very exciting things, things that they're excited about. I think they have this big vision for them, but I think they're not so arrogant as to not realize that that vision can change. You know, this is a dynamically shifting thing, but the key to all these technologies are really that they're foundational and they have many possible advantages and applications across a lot of Apple's business. So the augmented reality stuff, I think we're seeing come to fruition in the iPhone. It's great technology for the iPhone, VR and all this stuff. But in addition to that, a lot of this research can go into this other project that they're working on, this bigger thing, this next generation revolutionary thing. And Apple's ability to do this kind of cross-pollination has really served them well in recent years. So I think they're more willing to do that. You know, things like iOS, features in iOS giving way to features in macOS and vice versa. Look at the heart of the Apple Watch. So the S1 chip has made its way into your MacBook Pro, and it drives the touch bar or a variation of that. You know, basically, or sorry, it's watchOS, not the chip. It has a separate kind of chip, but watchOS is driving the touch bar in the MacBook Pro. And I think these are kind of great examples of this cross-pollination. So, you know, I think his choice to use the word autonomous system and not specifically autonomous car systems is very interesting. I think they're looking at, you know, this one application initially, but I think there's a even broader and bigger vision for how these technologies could be applied and could impact future Apple products and the world in general. So it was an interesting interview. And if you didn't catch it this week, you should take a moment to check it out. iFixit has done its thing with the new 10.5-inch iPad Pro. They've torn it down and revealed some of its secrets. Well, maybe not secrets, but they found some interesting stuff inside there. iFixit noted that the internal layout of the 10.5-inch iPad, while you may have thought, well, it's just a scaled-up 9.7-inch, right? No, it actually internally looks more like a shrunk-down 12.9-inch iPad. It's got this symmetric beauty to it, just like the 12.9-inch iPad. If you've never seen the inside of one, basically, what you have is you have two big batteries, one on the left side, one on the right side, and then this thin strip of a logic board right down the middle. That's very, very cleanly and nicely laid out. You know, I know a lot of Apple products are, but this one is particularly, I think, beautiful on the inside. So if you haven't had a chance to catch the pictures, head over to iFixit and check those out. But they did say that's also nice because that means the display cables are right down the center of the device, and taking it apart, while not simple, it does move those cables out of harm's way, and you can get in there without potentially dismantling or damaging those cables. And once inside, they noted that Apple has switched in many places to using standard Phillips screws. So no more of the proprietary weird screws so that you can't get in there. And another interesting thing is that new 120 hertz display has twice the number of connecting cables. So the current generation or the last generation of iPads, they actually have two connecting cables for the display. The new display requires four. And again, they're right there laid out in the middle. A few other interesting items of note. They confirmed that, yes, the new iPad does have 4 gigabytes of RAM, and as you may expect, just a slightly bigger battery than the 9.7-inch iPad, coming in at 30.8 watt hours. And the new iPads, yes, they are screamers. They have a very good performance. Amazing performance, as a matter of fact. And one thing I wanted to touch on is there's been some speed tests and reports coming out. Actually, one of my favorite speed testing websites, Barefeats, that's BareFeats.com, Barefeats.com, did some benchmarking on a 2017 10.5-inch iPad Pro versus a couple of 2017 MacBook Pros. And they used Geekbench and GFX bench tests. And surprisingly, the 2017 MacBook Pro just barely edged out the iPad Pro in the multi-core tests. Now, in the single-core tests, the MacBook won pretty handily. But then things got really interesting because they did the GPU test. They did a metal GPU test and a graphics test, and the iPad Pro beat out the MacBook Pro, at least with the pure Geekbench scores. Now, that sounds great and interesting and makes great headlines, and a lot of websites this week wrote about this test, but here's the thing, and here's my issue with these tests. They're fun, but they really don't mean much in real-world scenarios. In and of themselves, just to not confuse things, yes, good benchmark scores are going to mean good performance for a device. But the way you use a MacBook Pro and the operating system that it's running is infinitely different than the way you're going to use an iPad Pro and the way its operating system is running. Yes, Apple says an iPad Pro can be a laptop replacement, and it can for some, but depending upon what you're doing and how you're using it and all this stuff, those have to factor into these things as well. So what I really take away from these is the MacBook Pros are amazing. They're screamingly fast. They have great graphics. They're going to run macOS really, really well. They're going to run all your applications amazingly and be blazingly fast. The iPad Pro, amazing, amazing technology. Super fast screen, super fast 3D graphics, super fast processor. It's an amazing iPad. And if you need to do iPad things or you want an iPad as your main machine, it is going to be freaking awesome. Other than that, I think comparing the two is not really worthwhile. It's an exercise in just fun, but not a lot of practicality. At least that's my two cents on it. So, you know, don't get too distracted by, oh, the new iPad Pro is faster than the MacBook Pro. Again, I think you could put one in one test and one in the other, and it would go one way, and do some different tests, and it'll go completely the other way. So application has a lot to do with it, just as much as just a raw benchmark score. So benchmark score is fun, but not really practical. All right, I think I drove that home properly enough, maybe a little bit too much. So sorry about that. Moving on. Apple, it seems like, is hoping that all your medical records will belong to iPhone. At least that's what a CNBC report is trying to say. They say that Apple wants to become a sort of centralized bank for health information, or they want your iPhone, more accurately, to become a centralized bank of health information. And they're expanding their health app, according to this report, to not only encompass wellness data, like the number of steps you're taking and your heart rate and all the things that we can collect on our iPhones today, you know, calorie counts, but that Apple also wants you to be able to keep your medical records there, your lab results, your allergy lists, all that stuff. And not only that, they want you to have it there and then give you the ability to let your device share that information with your doctors, your healthcare providers, even family members when they need it. Now, it's not really clear how Apple is planning to accomplish this, but they're hiring a lot of smart people. They're developing a lot of interesting technology. They're adding developers, they're talking to hospitals, and more importantly, talking to industry groups about how they can do this. They're joining up with the industry groups, so they're getting involved in this area in a really big and deep way. And this is how Apple typically approaches these kinds of problems to try and find solutions, and I think it's really the right way to go. They've also been looking at acquisitions to support their efforts. Another thing that they'll do is start acquiring companies, I think really what they look for is mind share, sort of the best in the industry at solving these problems currently, bringing them on board, and then really looking for a solution. The piece basically says Apple wants to build like an iTunes or an iPhoto library for your health data. And why are they doing this? You know, what's the problem that they're trying to solve? And currently what it is how difficult it is to access and share these documents across and between healthcare providers and different labs and things like that. Anybody who's gone through this with healthcare, especially in the US, I think it probably varies from country to country, but you know, there really is no centralized repository. A lot of hospitals and health providers don't share this data or information. It's hard if you want to switch doctors or move between. You have to go make requests, and it takes days, and it takes a really long time. So the idea here is you just have it all there right in the palm of your hand. And I think it's a good idea, but there, of course, are a lot of challenges, especially on the regulatory side, especially on the privacy side. Apple is going to have to figure out how to manage and maintain those storage records, be able to share them in an appropriate way, in a secure way, and also not run afoul of regulations. And again, I think that's what they're doing by going to sort of the leaders in this, and more importantly, to industry organizations who are already working on trying to figure out and solve this problem. And of course, one answer to this could be partnerships. CNBC actually says Apple is working now with a company called Health Gorilla to add diagnostic data to the iPhone by cooperating with hospitals, imaging centers, and lab testing companies. Now, Health Gorilla says that they offer, quote, a secure clinical network that aggregates health data from a range of providers, offering doctors and hospitals access to a comprehensive overview of a patient's health. So again, here's an area where Apple's finding a partner, somebody who's already kind of working in the space, has already figured out some of these challenges, and hopefully that's going to yield some interesting results. I like the idea. Again, I would be very concerned about the security and privacy aspect of it. But to date, Apple has shown that they're pretty responsible, or at least they think very responsibly and seriously about that sort of thing, more so, I think, than other tech companies. I think the piece also points out that Google and a couple of other companies have tried to enter the space and failed. They've not made much headway and ultimately given up. And so it'll be interesting to see what Apple can or might be able to do in this space. Another space that we know Apple's been playing around with and really trying to make some headway is in entertainment, more specifically television and movies, trying to put together, you know, we had so many rumors that Apple might actually do an actual TV set. Then we started to hear these rumors that Apple wanted to build a sort of cable subscription kind of service, a streaming service that their customers could subscribe to, and that was kind of difficult. And more recently, we've been talking about the fact that Apple may be looking at going after kind of the Netflix, Amazon, Hulu model and creating their own original content. Now, they haven't done too much to date. I think so far, you know, we really have the nascent shows of Planet of the Apps, which is out right now. I've actually been watching it. I don't know if you've had a chance to see. I've watched all three episodes that they've released so far. My reaction, somewhat underwhelming. I found a couple of the episodes interesting. It's interesting to get a glimpse into sort of how developers work. The most interesting part for me so far has been actually the venture capital part. You know, what it's like for developers to go in and try and actually get money for their projects. And I can tell you, it doesn't look like fun at all. It looks like very stressful. And I imagined that part of it, but it's interesting to see what the VC funds, what the VC firm, at least that Apple is working with, is sort of looking for when it's picking out projects. So I found that to be the most interesting part of the show. But I almost did another pun. In reality, it's just your standard run-of-the-mill reality TV. And I don't know that it's all that compelling. Of course, they've got Carpool Karaoke, the series coming up. That's been delayed, which I think has not been good for Apple. So I think they've been struggling a little bit in this area of original programming. Well, something happened this week where Apple hired a couple of Sony, or now I guess ex-Sony TV executives, Jamie Ehrlich and Jack Van Amburg, for new positions. They say they're going to be overseeing all aspects of video programming worldwide at Apple, reporting directly to Eddie Q, Senior Vice President of Internet Software and Services at Apple. And both these guys served as presidents at Sony Pictures Television. They oversaw shows like Better Call Saul, which was a spinoff of Breaking Bad, also The Crown and Rescue Me. And the PR didn't give a lot of specifics, but online, most people are thinking that these two guys are being brought in to beef up Apple's original programming efforts and that they're going to be doing more in this space. So far, it's been sort of relegated to Apple Music, but there's a lot of people who are speculating and believe that Apple may start adding original programming content to some sort of upcoming service, whether that'll be rolled into Apple Music or Apple TV. That remains to be seen. I can see that, but I also kind of feel and think that this hire is more about the relationships and expertise that these guys have in television and this sort of ever-changing TV market. Apple has been having a hard time making some headway with their current people, and I think getting some real seasoned television executives in can only help with that, what Apple is trying to do. I think they're looking to do more in this space, and these are the kinds of guys that could really broker some deals. I don't think this is all just about original programming content, and Apple in the past has sort of expressed that that's really not what they're trying to do. So it was surprising to see so many of the reports kind of talking about, oh, this is Apple going directly after Amazon or Netflix, and I don't think that's going to be the case. I would love to see Apple do some more interesting things with original programming, specifically with like serialized television content and movies. I think with their cash on hand, the kind of money they have around and the talent they have there, they could do some really great things outside of things like reality TV shows. So I'd love to see that happen. Whether it does or not, I'm really kind of mixed about that at this point. But, you know, what do you think? Is this all about original programming? Is this a place Apple should really push into? Or have they already kind of missed that boat and they really should kind of focus in some different areas? I think it needs to be a different focus, but that's just my sort of gut reaction to this. When Scott Forstall left Apple, there was a lot of speculation, a lot of questioning about why he was leaving, what sort of went on. Most people, I think, thought that he was basically forced out after the whole debacle with Apple Maps and also over a falling out between design differences with Jony Ive. That Forrestal was all about this sort of skeuomorphism and design aesthetic like that, and Apple and Jony wanted to move in a different direction with this new flat interface, and that they had sort of come to a head. So a lot of people, you know, have speculated a lot about what happened there, but the one person who's never really talked about any of that is Scott Forrestal. He went on and did other things, including becoming a Broadway producer. And this week, there was an interview published by the Computer History Museum available to watch over on Facebook. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It's actually a two-part interview, and it's all about the development of the iPhone. So Forrestal was, of course, intimate in development of the iPhone and the operating system. And he's actually in the second part of the interview. They start off with three iPhone engineers and then go on to the interview with Scott. And if you haven't had a chance to check it out, I would encourage you to really go over and watch it. But some interesting things came out of the interview. He didn't talk directly and wasn't asked directly about, you know, the whole, you know, why did he leave and what really happened. It was more about talking about the technology and the development of the iPhone and also a number of personal things about Scott himself. One thing that I knew, but I never really thought about, you know, Forrestal really was Steve's kind of guy. He actually came over to Apple with Steve from Next. He was an employee at Next and had worked with Steve Jobs at Next. And Steve was really kind of, it felt like grooming Scott to ultimately maybe be his replacement. You know, had things gone differently, that may have been what happened. Of course, now we know Steve handpicked Tim Cook. Was that always going to be the case? Who really knows? Again, that's a little bit more speculation. But he talked about the development of the iPhone, which was codenamed Project Purple, and said that it was actually a reaction to Steve not liking some comments from a Microsoft executive. Apparently, Steve's wife had a friend whose husband worked for Microsoft, and he was going off on how great these Microsoft tablets were going to be and that they were going to be the next sort of coming of PCs and the next big thing. And that really sort of irked Steve, and it was at that sort of moment that he decided, we're going to make this touchscreen device that doesn't require a stylus that uses your finger, and it's going to be amazing. Some other interesting sort of personal anecdotes from the interview. Forrestal said that Steve actually saved his life with acupuncture. Apparently, Scott had developed some sort of stomach virus that was really bad, and he was losing weight, and his health was doing not well at all. And Steve came over and said, I have this acupuncturist I'm going to send you to, and she's going to cure you, or send over to you, and she's going to cure you. And it worked. You know, so say what you want or don't about alternative medicine. You know, according to Forrestal, he was saved by acupuncture and Steve. So that was kind of an interesting thing, a story that I hadn't heard before. But ultimately, the one thing that they did get down to and somewhat addressed was this idea of skeuomorphism debate. They didn't go into, again, he didn't come right out and say, hey, did you and Johnny I fight over this? And is this one thing that led to your departure from Apple? It wasn't like that. But he asked him about the skeuomorphism and the design. And I thought Scott handled it really, really well. And basically, he just came out and said, look, you know, the idea at Apple has always been to create easy to use, friendly and approachable design interfaces. And borrowing from real life makes a lot of sense. You know, real life objects and the real life representations of things. And if you look at Apple's history, specifically the Mac desktop, that's exactly what it did. The idea of a trash can and files and folders that, you know, might be on your desk. These were all very tangible, sort of real world things. And so it was very natural to use photo illustrative designs and metaphorical designs for an operating system. They were sort of built into Apple's design philosophy and DNA, and so they used those design philosophies. And, you know, to be honest, it worked. You know, those designs, I loved. A lot of us loved those designs. They were good designs for the time. They were better in some applications than others, and that's really true, I think, of any sort of design paradigm, right? Some applications are great, some maybe not so great, but overall, you know, it was really good. I think it's also true that very few designs are timeless. There's a few, but trends take over, and I think it sort of just played out its usefulness. So these last comments are mine. They're not from the interview, but I thought, you know, he handled it really well and sort of showed that I don't think this was as big a deal as the media really made it out to be. And that was my general sense I got coming out of it. But, you know, you might watch it and have a different opinion. So if you have had a chance to watch it, or you do go watch it, and you want to sort of make any comments about it, mention anything that stood out to you, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And kind of speaking on the area of interesting designs, have you seen these pictures of Apple's new store on the Chicago River, the Apple store on the Chicago River? Some early, I think, concept designs came out a few months back, and it looks gorgeous. It's this beautiful building. It's got a number of the design elements that are similar to features of the new Apple Park campus. So these curved glass panels on the front, although I think they're sort of concave instead of, you know, round and convex like they are on Apple Park for the Chicago River store, because it's right along the river. And they also use a very similar carbon fiber roof. So if you've seen the roof on the new Steve Jobs Theater at Apple Park campus, that's this huge, it looks like a silver disc, but it's carbon fiber. And they sort of have a similar one on the top of this Chicago store. And it's not surprising that the design looks very similar to the design of Apple Park, because it's by Forrester and Partners, the same company that's doing the project for Apple Park is doing this store design in Chicago. But this week, the interesting thing that happened was this carbon fiber roof, it is a rounded rectangle. And this week, a bunch of workers installed a giant white Apple logo on the roof of the building. So now from the air, it actually looks like the lid or the top of a MacBook. It looks like a MacBook Air, really, which is kind of cool. So if you haven't had a chance to check that out, that's very interesting. And I guess now as you're maybe flying out of O'Hare, you're going to see the world's largest MacBook Air. That's Apple's new retail store. Speaking of Apple Park, too, another thing just sort of in the retail and consumer, or I guess, fan side of things, is that Apple is now hiring for staff at the Apple Park Visitor Center. So if you've ever been to the Apple campus in Cupertino, you know they have the company store. But beyond that, visitors really didn't have a place to go. Well, the new Apple Park campus is actually going to have a 10,000 square foot space with an Apple store, a visitor center cafe where you can actually go in and grab a bite to eat. Apple employees can also go in there, and a whole visitor center. So it should be amazing. They're staffing up for it now. So that's making it look like it should be open fairly soon. The campus, I think Tim Cook had said they were going to start moving staff in April. I don't know how far along they are with that. But, you know, for those of us who are fans, we may be able to get into the visitor center sometime soon. And I'm sure we'll hear when that opens up, hopefully before the end of the summer. And then the last thing to talk about sort of in the news for this week is the new iMac Pro. Apple showed that off at Worldwide Developer Conference. They said it's going to be coming out in December. Well, the blog Pikes Universum was doing some digging in the firmware code for the latest Mac OS High Sierra and trying to decipher some clues about the possible architecture of the upcoming iMac Pro, trying to figure out, you know, what exactly is going to be under the hood. Although Apple did give us a kind of nice picture of the internals of that machine. Not a lot of details really there, but a few that actually led into some of the stuff that Pikes Universum discovered or found. What we already know is that Apple said it's going to feature Intel Xeon processors. Beyond that, we didn't know a lot of specifics. So at first, Pikes, after looking through some of these things, they felt that Apple was going to use something called Purely Xeon. So that's a code name for some Xeon processors that Intel is working on. And they have a special kind of socket, an LGA 3647 socket, which is different than their LGA 2066 socket. And I didn't know what any of this stuff was either. But basically what you need to know is the 2066 socket is kind of like the standard socket that they use. And the LG 3647 is for kind of beefier server grade, you know, big massive Xeon processors. So it kind of was exciting that they might be using these bigger ones. Well, further research showed that Intel has a roadmap for something called a Basin Falls, again, another code name, Basin Falls workstation that uses a Xeon processor like the iMac Pro will. And this Basin Falls architecture uses a server socket R or the LGA 2066 socket, whereas the top-of-the-line Xeons, the platinum and gold ones, would use that other type of socket, the LGA 3647. And then the other thing that they sort of discovered later was that the top-of-the-line Xeon processor chips support 6 memory channels. And here's where that image of the iMac Pro internals that Apple showed off comes into play. That internals picture shows that the iMac Pro only has four memory modules, so 4 memory channels. So what they concluded after all this, and also after looking at file name references that showed up that not only mentioned Purely, but also mentioned Basin Falls, this other kind of architecture, they decided, okay, well, it looks like the iMac Pro is going to have Purely Xeons, but likely using this LGA 2066 socket. And what's interesting about this is that Intel announced sort of next generation Skylake-based CPUs called Intel Core X series. There's going to be actually an i9 processor. So to date, we've had i3, i5, i7. There's an i9 in this Intel Core X series, sort of these top-of-the-line CPUs that are designed for like really high-end desktops, really like gaming desktops and stuff like that. And the clock speeds and the cores on these seem to line up perfectly with what Apple has announced. So the CPUs, these Intel Core X CPUs, have 8, 10, and 18 core offerings, all supporting 4 memory channels, right? So you're like, oh, well, that perfectly lines up. Are they using those Intel Core X series? The thing is as near as I can tell, and I tried to get into this, when you start getting into like these processor things, Intel's processor roadmap, it's like this whole cryptography exercise, really, and it's hard to tell. But as near as I can tell, the Intel Core X series, I don't believe these are Xeon processors, and Apple specifically said the iMac Pro is going to have Xeons. So what Pikes concluded, and I think this makes sense, is that Apple might be getting some Xeon SKUs, some Xeon processors that are in similar configurations to these Intel Core X i9 processors. And that seems possible to me because Apple has often received kind of customized configurations for their machines, specifically from Intel, that are generally not available to consumers at large. You know, they're not off-the-shelf processors that a consumer could just go in and buy. And often they're processors that aren't made available to other manufacturers. So this may be some sort of hybrid of the Intel Core X series and the Xeon lineup that's making its way into the iMac Pro. But again, we're not really going to know until Apple starts actually shipping the thing. But still, it's interesting to think about. And in case you haven't heard of them before, Pikes Universum, they leaked some things about the upcoming MacBook Pros, and those turned out to be accurate. So they're becoming a fairly reliable source for Apple rumors. The other thing that the blog also concluded was that they found that there were some references to that made it look like the iMac Pro may be coming with its own secure enclave processor, excuse me, an ARM-based processor like we've seen in other Mac models. This is actually something that's in the Touch Bar MacBook Pros to help drive the Touch ID sensor that's on there. And so the assumption here, because there's these references and it seems like the iMac Pro is going to have that hardware, the assumption is that Touch ID support is probably coming to the iMac Pro. Where and how it's going to be implemented, though, is a little bit gray. One thing we do know is that the iMac Pro is going to have this sort of customized space gray magic set of magic peripherals. So magic keyboard, magic trackpad, magic mouse in this matching space gray color. So it could be that there's going to be a Touch ID sensor somehow integrated into those, or that maybe Apple's actually going to release, along with the iMac Pro, a new Magic Keyboard with a Touch Bar. And I think that is probably the more likely scenario, that Apple is gearing up and they're planning to release a Magic Keyboard with a Touch Bar. That's probably going to have the Secure Enclave built into it. You know, the price of that thing, I was debating this with a MacCast listener this week. I'm thinking $200, $300 range if Apple does a Magic Keyboard with a Touch Bar. The one question was, if it's wireless, is it going to have enough bandwidth, either Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, to actually drive the display without a lot of latency? And the one thing I can think of there is Apple may use, again, its own special chip, like the W1 chip, that they have in the AirPods, some sort of variant of that that may be using proprietary wireless connectivity that could have a better throughput, maybe lower latency than Bluetooth or something like that, to actually make that happen and still have it be wireless. Of course, they could also just go purely with a Thunderbolt 3 USB-C connection, although I think we've moved beyond wired keyboards, so I can't imagine Apple actually doing that. But a lot of people, ever since Apple showed off the Touch Bar, myself included, I felt it's just natural that Apple would do a Magic Keyboard with a touch bar. And so I think some of these references in Mac OS High Sierra could be alluding to the fact that Apple is working on that. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Starting off the feedback portion, I want to follow up and clarify something related to something we were talking about on a recent show. I had shared a story from a listener who had had, unfortunately, his iPhone stolen by a teen who came up and asked to borrow his phone, said, hey, I don't have my phone with me. I need to call my parents. He took sympathy on him, handed him his phone, and the guy ran off, threw it over the fence to some waiting people and got away. And in that show, the question was, since we have activation lock, you know, why do people still steal iPhones? And we dove into that in that episode. So if you missed it, go back and take a listen. But also in that show, the victim had mentioned that he wasn't able to track his phone with Find My iPhone. So they had apparently disabled that or done something to turn off the phone right away. And because of that, he chose to do a remote wipe of the device. And that prompted listener Michael to send me an email and ask this question. He says, quote, doesn't doing a remote wipe from iCloud remove the activation lock? I think unless you absolutely have given up, you don't want to do a remote wipe on a stolen device, right? And the short answer, Michael, is no. The only way to remove activation lock from a device is to actually remove the device from iCloud, which is typically done by turning off Find My iPhone on the device, not necessarily remote wiping it. And I emailed this back to Michael, and it actually still caused some confusion between him and I, and we went back and forth with a series of emails sending links to Apple support articles, and Michael cited one of them that had some steps that he was using when he was transferring old phones to his relatives. So when he get a new phone, and those steps were saying that, you know, from iCloud.com, if you go to iCloud.com/find on another device or a Mac and you sign in with your Apple ID, you click on the all devices at the top of the screen, you select the device you want to remove from iCloud, you click erase phone, and then after your device has been erased, you click remove from account. And that removes the activation lock, removes it from your account, and makes it available for someone else to authorize. And that's a little bit different because notice the click to remove from account, that's step five. But there's an earlier step that says erase the phone. Two separate steps. And this was causing some confusion, and I think it really needs to be clarified. As a matter of fact, Michael mentioned that the option to just erase the device and not remove it from iCloud is not there, but that's actually step three, right? Remove the device from iCloud, erase the phone. If you do not do step five, I'm pretty sure you should be okay, and the activation lock would remain intact. So there's really a difference between erasing or remote wiping the phone and actually removing it from your account. Those are two separate steps. And this is played out in a few of these different Apple support articles. There's actually an Apple article on what to do if you've lost or have a stolen iPhone. And I'll link to this in the show notes at maccast.com. But they recommend doing a couple different things. The first is try Find My iPhone. So if you have Find My iPhone turned on, see if you can't locate your device. The second is turn on something called Lost Mode. And Lost Mode is good because it lets you lock your iPhone with a passcode. And if you do end up getting it back, you can use the passcode to just get back into the device and use it as if nothing happened. You can also, in Lost Mode, display a custom message so you can say, hey, this phone is lost. If you find it, call this number. And while it's in Lost Mode, you're still able to track the device with Find My iPhone. In addition, if you use Apple Pay, it also suspends the ability to use Apple Pay on that device. So in essence, it kind of locks it down in a way. It protects your data. and you can continue to track it. They also say you should report a stolen device to local law enforcement, which I think is good advice. And so these are kind of the first three things that they recommend you do. And then if you decide, hey, it doesn't look like I'm going to get the device back, I'm worried about my data, they say erase your device. But they also do point out that the one ability you do lose when you erase your device is the ability to use Find My iPhone. That will no longer work. But specifically, they point out that after erasing the device, the activation lock would remain intact until you removed your device from your account. So again, I think this proves that the key here really is, if you still want to be able to track your device after you've lost it and you have Find My iPhone turned on, do not remotely erase your device. Once you've decided to remotely erase your device, however, you can still keep your phone protected from being reused and keep the activation lock in place as long as you do not remove it from your iCloud account. And if you want to see what devices are associated with your account, you can log into iCloud.com. You can go to the settings area and look at the My Devices section. These are the devices that are attached to your account, and any iPhones that would be attached there would presumably have, if you've ever enabled Find My iPhone, would have the activation lock in place. So this is also the area where you can remove a device from your account and make it available to be reused. So if you're planning on selling your device, this is a place you're going to want to go into and make sure that you've disabled that. You can also do all this stuff on the phone, but the key is to remove activation lock, you need to remove it from your account. And I think hopefully that clears up any of this confusion. I know browsers can be a somewhat kind of personal thing, and everybody has their preferences, but I am a Safari user. I think a lot of Mac and Apple people are Safari users, and it's got some really great features in it. And one of those really great features is reading list, the ability to kind of find an article, quickly save it off if you don't have maybe time at the moment to read it, and have a place where you can come back and get to it later. And David emailed me this week wanting to know if there was a way to add a reading list icon to the toolbar in Safari, kind of so you have quick access to reading list. And I think the ability to add things to the reading list. And David, I think that there is not a way to put it in the toolbar. So, you know, typically if you go in, you can select customized toolbar and you can change those icons around. There isn't really a way to put it there, but it is the first item under the share icon. So it's like two clicks away instead of, I think, just one click away. Or the other thing that I think I'd recommend to you is remembering the keyboard shortcut. If you hit Command Shift D, that will add whatever website you're currently on to your reading list. So you can do it that way. In addition, if there's a link on a website, if you control or right click on any link in Safari, there is an add to reading list option. So you have a couple of quick ways to add it, just not specifically adding it to the toolbar. But David was asking if anybody knew of a way, if there was a plugin or an add-on. I wasn't able to find anything, but maybe the MacCast community can help you out there, David. But hopefully between one of these tips and maybe another tip that someone might send us, that answers your question. But I wanted to just comment on reading list a little bit more. You know, it's a way to build this custom list of articles or items that you want to come back to or read later or save. And what's great about it is it syncs via iCloud. So if you have Safari or use Safari on other Macs and other devices, your reading list will get updated and you'll have all that stuff to go along with you. You can view items that you've read or just have an archive of items of stuff that you've wanted to save. And you can access your saved items later by using the reading list tab, which is the little glasses icon in the sidebar on Safari on the Mac, and it's in the bookmarks bar in Safari on iOS. And you can actually search items in a reading list. If you just pull down on that sidebar area or scroll down a little bit, you can access a search box. So if you have a number of items, or if you remember you saved off a specific article about something, you can actually search through it. If you need to remove items or mark them as read on the Mac, you just hover over the item and you'll see a little X icon appear and you can click to remove it. If you right click or control click on the item on the Mac, you can access a submenu that will give you the ability to mark an item as read or unread. And there's also delete and clear all options there. On iOS, you just simply swipe left across and you will see the options for removing or marking an item as read or unread. And then at the bottom of the window, there's a little link that will allow you to either view all of the articles that you've saved into your reading list or just the unread ones. And then finally, if you use the command key while clicking a reading list item on the Mac, that will allow you to quickly open that up in a new tab and go ahead and read that. And I think I've mentioned before that another one of my favorite features in Safari is the reader view. And if you combine reader and reading list, you have a really powerful and great way, I think, to read especially long form articles and posts in a distraction-free way. So you can command click a reading list item, open it up in a new tab, and then click on the reader icon, which is the four little lines that appear on the left side of your Safari URL bar. Click that and it pops up in the reader distraction-free mode. And what I love about reader is once you're in there, you can change the font size by clicking on the little AA font icon. And you can also change some of the styling. So you can change the font, you can change the font size, you can change the background. So if you prefer to have dark mode or light mode or sepia, all of those options are in there. And it really makes for a great reading experience. And it's built right into Safari, both on the Mac and iOS. So play around with that a little bit. And then another handy Safari trick that I'll just give you is, and something I often forget about, it's using iCloud tabs. So if you use iCloud for syncing along with Safari on the Mac or iOS, when you click the tabs icon and you get to the little tabs view that shows all of your tabs, scroll down a little bit, scroll to the bottom, and at the bottom of that, you'll see a list of tabs that are open in Safari on every one of your Macs or devices. And as a matter of fact, this is kind of cool, you can close tabs on another device. So if you're on your Mac and you're using iCloud tabs, you can actually close the tabs that are open, say, on your iPad if you want to. So you can see them, you can access them, you can also close them. So on the Mac, if you just hover over those, again, you'll get a little X icon and you can close them. Of course, you can click on them to open them up in your current device or the Mac that you're working on. And then on iOS, you just swipe left and you'll get to delete options if you want to delete the tabs. And I use that, you know, from time to time when I remember it, because I'll be sitting at my Mac going, oh, I was just looking at something on my iPad and I want to go back to that article, and lo and behold, there it is in the open tabs. So a couple quick cool little tips between reading list and some few other features inside Safari for you. Now I want to talk a little bit about hidden interfaces, and I'm going to lead into this with an email that I received from Eric, who was having trouble with his music app on his iOS device. He wrote in to say that his iPhone was stuck on shuffle and he could not figure out how to stop it. No matter what he did, whatever he would play, playlist, album, didn't matter, it would start playing on shuffle. He could not get it to play from beginning to end. He even tried starting up and tapping on the shuffle option for an album. So, you know, if you go into the music app and you're looking at an album, it'll have a shuffle option at the top. He tried tapping that. That just shuffled the music as well. So he was completely baffled and was looking for some help. And the trouble Eric was having was something that I've actually suffered from too. And it's Apple's latest affinity for having secret hidden user interfaces. And it's something that I think is horrible from a UI perspective, and it drives me batty, completely batty. I think this is a big usability problem for Apple, and I think it's getting worse and not better. A great example of this, in case you don't know what I'm talking about, is the Do Not Disturb or Night Shift toggles in the Notification Center on the Mac. Did you know those were there? Some of you probably don't, but if you go into Notification Center, you have to scroll or swipe down, and then you'll see these toggles for Do Not Disturb and Night Shift. Of course, you can access them in other areas, but that's not the point. If you didn't know they were there, there's no way you could know they were there. There's no UI hint. There's no information that would tell you. You really would not have a clue unless someone told you. So getting back to Eric's issue, my suspicion, and it turned out to be correct, was that he had been a victim of the shuffle button, which is in the currently playing sheet, or the now playing sheet. So in the music app, when the now playing sheet is up, you get the music controls, you get the album art, you get all kinds of information. But what many people don't realize is that if you pull up on that sheet, there are a couple of extra buttons. And guess what? One of them is the shuffle toggle, which when activated will shuffle all of your music all of the time. So somehow that accidentally got turned on. You know, maybe as you're sticking it in your pocket, you accidentally brush that, something that could happen. And then the next time you open it up, suddenly everything's just shuffling. You have no idea why. And that turned out to be what it was in Eric's case. Also under there is the repeat button. And the repeat, when you tap on it each time, it changes whether you're repeating song or you're repeating all. And the main reason I was able to help Eric out and knew about this was because my daughter came to me one day and she said, "Dad, my music, every time I play it, it just keeps playing the same song over and over and over again. I can't get it to play any other song. What's going on?" And it took me about 15 minutes of poking around and then ultimately some Googling to figure out where this control was. I knew what the problem was. I knew it was the tap to repeat song option, but I simply could not find the control for it. Of course, because it was hidden. Completely infuriating, and I don't know why Apple continues to do this, especially with like key elements like this. So I thought, since Eric wrote in about this, I want to just point out some other useful hidden user interface elements that you may or may not know about. One of them is, did you know you have timestamps in messages? Have you ever been in messages and want to go back in your history and you're wondering, when was that message sent? They used to be there, just visible, and then Apple hid them away off to the right-hand side of your phone. So if you're in messages, if you swipe left, if you pull to the left, the timestamps will magically peek out from the right side of your phone inside messages. So that's a handy little one. I already mentioned the Notification Center thing with the toggles for Do Not Disturb and Night Shift. The other one is search in many areas. We kind of talked about that a little bit earlier, but a lot of times if you're looking for a search box, especially on iOS, try swiping down on an area. Like on the home screen in iOS, you can access your search box. A lot of people always just swipe to the left to access the search area, but you can pull down right from any springboard screen and get the search box at the top of iOS. And a lot of people don't know about that because it's hidden. And then 3D Touch on iOS. If you have a 3D Touch device, I would just advise you 3D Touch on everything and see what happens. I mean, that's the only way you're going to discover a lot of these features, either that or reading articles or someone telling you about a tip. But yeah, 3D Touch on everything and see what your options are and learn those. On an iPad or an iPhone that supports 3D Touch, did you know that there's a trackpad available? It's hidden under your on-screen keyboard. On the iPad, if you just simply drag with two fingers, you can access that touchpad. And what it allows you to do is move the cursor around in any kind of text application. So if you're working with text, you can use that to move the cursor around. You can also use it to make selections. So if you've started a selection And here's a tip. If you tap with two fingers on a word, it will select that word. If you double tap, it will select a whole line. And then you can use two fingers on the trackpad. Again, this is on an iPad, to actually change and modify your selection. With a force touch iPhone or a 3D touch iPhone, you just do a 3D touch and you can access the same things. Again, 3D touch on the on-screen keyboard. And then another one of my favorites, maybe not so favorites, is actions in the Photos application that are hidden under the share menu. So if you're looking at a photo just in an album or in the main photo library, if you tap on the share button, under actions, you'll find duplicate. So if you want to duplicate an image, say to do some editing, or if you want to hide an image, or if you want to use a photo as the wallpaper on your iPhone, you can access all of that from under the share menu in the actions. And then similarly, if you're in the people album and you've ever been going through someone's person's album and realized, hey, that picture is not of this person, it's incorrectly identified that person, how do you remove it? Well, that's actually hidden under the actions menu. So you have to tap select and then tap the image that you want to change and then hit the share button. And then you'll find a not this person option under the photo actions. There's also a make key photo. So if you want to change the key photo that shows up for that person in the people album, that's how you access it. And again, all of these things are like really hidden in a place where if you didn't know about them, I don't think you'd just organically find them, or it's very unlikely you'd organically find them. And I think it's, again, bad UI. And I'm sure there's probably some that I haven't mentioned that I don't know about. So if you have one of these, send it in as a tip. Send me a quick audio comment, a minute or two, and just let us know about a hidden feature, a hidden user interface feature in Mac or iOS that we don't know about. And I look forward to getting those from you because I'd love to learn more. I'm sure there's some that I have no clue about because, again, they're hidden. Stop hiding stuff from us, Apple, or make it easier to discover. One or the other. I don't know. Matthew wrote in this week to tell me that he was in, quote, desperation mode with his email. And Matthew, we don't want you to be in desperation mode with your email. Certainly not. And what he said was, quote, I'm looking for an email client for either macOS or iOS, preferably both, that allows me to do either of these two things. One, pre-populates the from field with an email address that the original email was sent to, or two, allows me to dynamically change the from field's address at compose time. And you might be asking, doesn't it already allow that? Or why is Matthew asking for this feature? And the reason is that Matt uses alias email addresses. And this is something that I use too, Matthew. I think it's incredibly handy. So some email services, I think Matthew is using Fastmail and I use Gmail. They allow you to make addresses that can start with almost anything and then be at yourdomain.com or at gmail.com. And in Gmail's case, what you do is you add a plus and then a secondary word. So, you know, maccast@gmail.com. I can also give somebody the email address, say mattcast+spam@gmail.com. And then I know if I receive an email with that to address that it came from a specific source. So it allows you to kind of track sources of emails and make sure that people aren't really abusing your email. I mean, that's one use for it. Or it can just be, you know, handy in having aliases. So it's usually anything at yourdomain.com, and then what happens is that still winds up in your main account's inbox. So you don't miss mail messages, but you kind of have a bunch of extra email addresses that you can give out. And the trouble is that if you receive an email from one of those aliased addresses, a service or a person, and then you try to reply to that, it will reply and put in the from field the email address from your main account, not the aliased email address. So you potentially expose your actual real email address. And so this was the issue that Matthew was trying to deal with. If you don't change the from to anything else, then it goes back that way. And out of the box, when you set up your email accounts, the only from option in the from dropdown, because you can change the from, but it's only for your registered accounts. So if you have, you know, your, if say the aliased account was a Gmail account, you might be able to change the from address to your iCloud email address. Not really what you want. What Matt is looking for is a solution that will allow him to send back from the actual aliased email address. And Apple actually does support, and their built-in mail application, Matthew, does support email aliases on accounts that you set up in mail. And I assume these would also work in most third-party clients as well. So I don't think you have to get necessarily a new email client. Now, it's not going to pre-populate it, so maybe there is an email client out there that does that. If you happen to know of one of these, tell us about it, because I want to pass that information along to Matthew. But Matthew, if you want to just use the ability to select those aliased email addresses in the from dropdown in mail, all you have to do is tell mail about the aliases that you actually have set up and used. So if you go into mail, preferences, accounts, and remember, and this drives me nuts too, but this is different than just going into mail accounts. You need to go into the mail application, go into preferences, and then into accounts, which gives you a little bit different view. Select the account you want to add the aliased addresses to. Click on the email address dropdown and choose edit email addresses. And then you'll get a window with a box where you can click a little plus button and add additional email addresses to that account. So just put your aliased email addresses, the ones that you use. So if it's, you know, spam@yourdomain.com or mattcast@yourdomain.com, put those into this box, click OK, then close the preferences, quit and reopen mail. And this is important because they won't show up until you've quit and reopened mail. But now when you receive a message and you want to reply, you can click in the from field and you will see the aliased email addresses that you've added to the mail preferences under accounts. And that should at least give you, you know, the solution for part two of your question without having to do anything additional, without having to get a new email client or anything else. So I hope that helps you out. And if we do hear from someone about an email application for iOS or Mac or both that pre-populates the from field with the email address that it was actually sent to, even if it's an aliased email address, I will share that with you on a future episode of the MacCast. I think one of the most amazing things about Apple as a company is how they create such a connection between people and Apple's products and the technology, right? The fact that we are so fanatical about these products is really a special thing. And even more special is how that connection to the products actually connects us to other people who share that passion. So what I'm talking about is the Apple community. The reason this podcast exists, right, is all about that connection and the community that it creates. I have hundreds of friends and thousands of acquaintances because of this community. It is this massive community, and every one of you is part of that for me. And it's an amazing and a powerful thing. And I think we all have that just by the nature of being in this community. Unfortunately, this week, though, I found out through one of the members of our MacCast community, Chelsea, about the loss of one of her friends, who's also a member of this extended community of Apple, you know, that Apple has created for us. And she wrote me and she asked me if I would share a letter she wrote to Tim Cook in remembrance of her friend. And of course, I'm happy and honored to be able to do so. Greetings, Mr. Cook. I'm writing you today to tell you a story about a very dear friend of mine whose life Apple impacted immensely. Her name is Megan Benning, and she is from Minnesota. Megan graduated cum laude in December of 2016 with a BS degree in computer information technology and a minor in psychology from Minnesota State University, Mankato. Computers and technology have always been a huge passion of hers, and that infectious enthusiasm transferred to Apple products and was completely contagious. Megan introduced me to the world-transforming and life-altering device that is the iPhone in 2010 and helped me switch to the Mac a year later. She collected as many iPods and Macs as she could from various places and has amassed quite a collection. I am enclosing photographs of her around the time of high school graduation, surrounded by the products that brought such richness and joy to her life, while also allowing her to contribute to the world. In addition to having an extreme affinity for any gadget, Megan was always willing to embody the Apple credo and share her experience, her expertise with others. We spent many long hours enjoyably discussing the future of technology in general, and Apple in particular. Megan loved Apple products for the same reasons we all do, but she had a special reason to take pride in mastering them. Megan and I are both blind and use VoiceOver to access our devices and use the technology your company has produced to live life to the fullest and do what we love. Tragically, Megan passed away on January 28, 2017, at the age of 22. All who knew her were deeply affected, as Megan was the kind of person who would light up any room she occupied with an ever-optimistic spirit, and we are all coping with her loss as best we can. It is the least I can do to honor her memory by making you aware of this incredible young woman and all your products empowered her to become. Megan's ultimate professional goal was to become a white hat hacker for the FBI or to work at Apple itself. While Megan never physically made it out to Silicon Valley, which was definitely another bucket list item of hers, I had the distinct honor of visiting your headquarters and the Apple store there. I picked up the t-shirt displaying all the Apple products for her, as it suited Megan perfectly. Per her wishes, Megan was cremated, and her mother contacted me to let me know that the shirt had gone in with her. In a soft but completely calm voice, she said, "Megan loved Apple, and Megan loved Chelsea, but obviously I couldn't put any electronics in the box, so I put in the shirt you gave her. Megan loved wearing that t-shirt. It had all the Apple products she owned, and it came directly from Apple via you. I wanted to do something that would represent the bond you two shared, and I thought the shirt would be perfect. It certainly was, and I'm still honored and touched by the gesture. While visiting an Apple store yesterday, I recounted this story to the sales specialist, and he was also touched. I intend to keep telling that story to associates at every Apple store I visit going forward as a way to carry Megan there and keep her amazing legacy living. Megan has not left my favorites list since I got my first iPhone 4, and she was the first person I corresponded with by text message. New product launches and Apple keynotes will never be the same. Because Megan and her pictures and spirit reached your inbox, I'm counting that as Megan finally reaching Silicon Valley and Apple headquarters. Thank you for everything that you do. Apple products proliferate throughout the world and have great life-changing impacts, most poignantly for people with disabilities. Without Apple products, I wouldn't have found such a supportive community where I can grow both personally and professionally, More importantly, Megan would likely not have had the richness of life she enjoyed, nor been able to pursue the career fitted to her passions. Thanks for heading the company that reminds us that we are all human and that diversity should be celebrated. Megan was definitely one of those crazy ones who changed the world. In loving memory of Megan Megabyte Benning, Chelsea Cook. Chelsea, thanks for sharing your friend's story, and I'm deeply sorry for your loss. As sad as that is, what I love about this is it really exemplifies the way that Apple touches people's lives and really makes a difference and really brings us all together in this like incredible community. And I was happy to be able to share this because, you know, it's just how I feel about this show and feel about the community in general. And I thought it was really great. And hopefully I did it justice. Sorry, I stumbled a little bit, but I hope you got what you wanted. And I do hope that Tim read your letter. So with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can check out all of their great software, get more information and details at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, the MacCast is all about community, so I love hearing from you. Please send me your emails, your audio comments, your questions, things you'd like to hear covered on future episodes of the MacCast. If you need help, anything you'd like to let me know about, send those emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes or links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to reach out to me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you're on Google Plus, we have a Google Plus community, google.com/plusMacCast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.